Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
So welcome to our cybersecurity series here. We have a guest today, Doug DePepe. Doug is a law attorney that focuses on security and privacy. So I guess it's not law, but security and privacy attorney. Doug, welcome to the show today.
Hey Chris, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you. And Doug, we want to know, you know, we're looking at the cybersecurity effort around Colorado here a lot. You've been deeply involved almost from the inception. But first of all, give us a background on your experience, where you've been, and how that fits in the cybersecurity realm.
Sure. Thanks, Chris. I'm retired military. I was a former military intelligence officer, and I got into the JAG Corps. And that's actually given me a lot of background because cyber is, you know, there's a law enforcement piece, there's an intelligence piece, there's a critical infrastructure and information sharing. And I've had a lot of those experiences in the Army JAG Corps. Toward the end, though, I ended up getting, the Army was looking to create cyber law expertise, whatever that was. We're going back 10, 15 years now. And I went off and got an advanced law degree, a master's of law, from George Washington University, and went back in and started practicing cyber law in the military. So it was support to military operations in cyberspace and through space. Retired in 2008 and went over to Department of Homeland Security, sort of rolled out more of my background in cyber, more into critical infrastructure and national programs, got involved with some White House initiatives, and finally got into private practice and have been practicing both consulting and cyber law, which I know we'll get into, for the past several years.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
You don't think of the military needing cyber law, right? They're about pounding, putting a hammer down, you know, doing some damage over the, wherever they're at. What is it that they need cyber law for in the military?
So the cyber is an interesting domain, right? There's international dimensions related to privacy. There's just in the law of armed conflict, the ordinary area that military lawyers practice in. When you now are engaging in intelligence or offensive operations, it's not as clear cut, oh, well, we're just going to do that. There are rules as to what you can and can't do. And so helping operators navigate that landscape, you know, and for an example would be if you were to do this notion of hackback. So if you've been attacked and if you were attacked in a ground perimeter, you'd fire back. But in cyberspace, if you fire back and the attacker has established a presence on a French university and you fire back at that French university and take out their network, that's a problem, right? So it's helping operators navigate the space and know what they can and can't do or what they can do through different means and different mechanisms.
So is that like you're protecting the individuals in the military that are doing this from legal action or the entity, the military itself?
Both.
Both.
Yeah, both. I mean, if they're in certain capacities more domestically, and that has its own challenges with posse comitatus and what they can and can't do domestically. But there are potential. If you go outside the bounds, there's a chance that you've exceeded the scope of authority. By and large, you're going to be protected by their status. But there's always some risk there. Certainly from a disciplinary standpoint, they could be in hot water. But more importantly, it's protecting the organization so that there's not there are international criminal courts, and there's a lot of ways that you can do something that can either get into the media. I mean, we're seeing that now with the Apple and the FBI outside of the military. But so we're seeing a lot of instances now where an incident gets into the public domain, creates a lot of controversy. And, you know, the military wants to comport with their international legal responsibilities, but there's also the impact from a domestic consumption of media standpoint.
Mm-hmm. So media that you could look bad, the government could look bad, or somebody in the government could look like they're a rogue operative. And then the legal aspect of, you know, kind of engagements of war. Are we engaging with a friendly, a foe? You know, if we don't declare war, I guess you can't just go after any asset. You have to say, hey, what is the requirement? So that's what I'm hearing, right?
Yeah, it's called outside of cyber, although cyber is getting into this, it's maybe more of this than ordinary military operations, this notion of operational law. And years ago, not that many years ago, 20 years ago, say, when JAGS first started getting into the command post, into the Tactical Operations Center, there was this notion of, okay, we need a lawyer here. Why exactly? But as we got into peacekeeping operations, insurgencies, these difficult areas, both functionally or operationally, but also legally, a lot of leaders, military leaders, have found that their JAG officer was among their most important staff officer, because just like an intelligence officer would advise on, you know, you may not want to attack here, you may want to attack here, or here's what we're seeing. That's the same sort of advice that a JAG staff officer provides in terms of left and right boundaries.
Okay. Very interesting. So now you transitioned into the government, Department of Homeland Security, and private sector. What do you then take from that military, from your experience, and make a market out of that, or support the greater good, we'll say, as far as DHS is concerned?
Sure. So I'll talk about private practice, and it's sort of it is the public-private practice area that we keep hearing about, and so I can put some meat on the bone on public-private partnerships and talk about what it is. But let me just step back and mention that just like the military got involved with operational law, what we're seeing in the private sector now is that cyber operators now, that the whole market is shifting to a services market in addition to the product market. So in other words, cyber, you think about your antivirus or your firewall, intrusion detection, all these different systems that you can put on the network. But we're seeing more and more that what companies need are services, whether it's a risk assessment or operators that are gathering intelligence. So cyber intelligence is a booming market now. And so what that, if we think about that for a moment, what's happening is that the private sector is doing things that the government traditionally does. So what do I mean by that? There was a company, Mandiant, that put out the APT-1 report a couple years ago now that outed the Chinese army for engaging in hacking. So other than in cyber, how common is it for a private company to provide an intelligence report that is both consumed by the government but also fundamentally changes the environment? I mean, that's typically something, that kind of intelligence, the underlying intelligence that led to that report, is something that the government traditionally does. And now we have the private sector doing it. And my last point, Chris, on that is that since I would just describe what I did in the military in order to keep operators informed of their left and right boundaries, we need that same service in the private sector now that the private sector is doing quasi-government operations.
Okay. Interesting. So what kind of path forward do you see? You know, we're talking here about the cybersecurity effort locally in Colorado Springs and nationally. I know you have a lot of national efforts going on. Give us some updates of what it is that you're plugged in with and how you're helping with from the legal aspect to develop the cybersecurity as an industry.
Sure. I'll mention two organizations. My law firm is EOS Edge Legal, and I know we're educating, we're informing. I don't want to make this a commercial advertisement, but basically all the things I learned I package into my firm in terms of how we go about the practice. So we've got two areas that we focus on. It sort of reflects the unfortunate cyber environment. You know, I described it as pre-breach and post-breach. As the FBI director Mueller had said, there's two types of organizations: those that have been breached, and those that don't know about it, and those that have been breached and they know about it. And there's different descriptions of that quote, but it's the notion that everyone is compromised, there's a large percentage of organizations that are compromised. So there's an awful big post-breach part, but on the pre-breach part, the advantage of a law firm is that our conversation, my client's conversation, is confidential. So a lot of companies don't even want to know what their problems are because they're so concerned about the brand impact, the cost, and so on. So I can go in on the pre-breach side and have a discussion, a knowledgeable discussion, since I'm in this space, about risks, about types of attacks, and help the organization form a game plan. And if they choose not to move forward or they're not going to adopt every recommendation, they don't have to worry about those decisions being later that they're being accused of errors and omissions or negligence, because that conversation, that game plan is confidential between the client and the attorney. And then the other area that we practice on the post-breach is a practice area called breach coaching. So breach coaching is, once you've had a breach, is to make sure that you're back into compliance. There's a lot of state data breach laws and other requirements in compliance in certain sectors by contract. There's a lot of ways that you have to comply with obligations. And there's the fiduciary responsibility as well. So we get on, we coach an organization that's been breached through that. And the beauty of it is that we call it cloaking. Because we can bring in a partner, a vendor that can do the technical services, and we have a whole alliance model to do that, it's a national model, their work can come in through the law firm, and there's a certain amount of privilege or confidentiality that's afforded to that model. So from left to right, from pre-breach to post-breach, we can cloak an awful lot of our activity and the services of our team in confidentiality to protect that from getting to plaintiff's counsel, which is the emerging litigation landscape we're in.
So we're looking at a company that wants some knowledge, some information, some help if they've had a breach, some help putting together a plan. You know, they know that things are going to come out and things are going to be identified that they can't spend enough money to address. So they want to have that all under privacy, that even if they have this report in hand, the people that did it for them can't leak it. And that's kind of what we're talking about here.
Not only that, but there's a way to shield it from access by third parties. So if there ends up being a breach and litigation ensues, then the data that's produced, and think about it, when you're a technologist in the cyber sphere, all the data that gets produced to figure out the root cause, well, that root cause is probably going to show some errors and omissions, and through certain privileges that only a law firm can introduce, we can protect a lot of that. So that's a real advantage.
Interesting. Yeah, and very interesting, because the company takes out a large errors and omission policy for their work, and if they, by their own internal evaluations, show some errors and omission, they can then be at fault, but this protects them from their own selves.
And it protects, it's interesting, it protects three entities. So it protects the client. It also protects the vendor, right? Because they're all in this zone of, the cone of silence, so to speak. From you can picture that imagery. The cone of silence comes down. For the younger generation, they may not get that, but someone my age at least, I know what the cone of silence is. That all of those inside the cone of silence have certain protections, right? And then the third party are the insurance industry, because any kind of litigation that ensues in for a covered customer, they're the payers. They're the end state, right? That's going to pay for any of these damages, and so they're protected as well. So it's a risk management feature that helps three customers.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
So I heard all corporate entities here. I've heard a lot of government talk, agencies, cloak and dagger behind the scenes, it sounds like. What does this do? What is the legal aspect for individual people that, you know, are worried about their privacy? Is there anything that you could say about that demographic of people?
Yeah, and it allows me to introduce the Cyber Resilience Institute, which is a national organization that's helping communities build their capacity. So the mission there, and related to your question, we all have a responsibility to be better informed. And Chris, your company does training, and you're aware that you're targeting that market. You're providing a service. And there are certainly companies have this responsibility to improve their cyber hygiene through training, through frameworks and processes that reduce risk, that ensure that has oversight to ensure that you don't just have a policy, but it's actually being enforced and so on. But we as individuals have a responsibility to be better informed, to not do, frankly, dumb things. And also some things, you know, click on things that we ought to know better. We ought to have a savviness at this point, whether it's the Nigerian scams, you get an email and it's so obviously poorly written. It's the tactic is transparent and yet people click on it.
Well, it
and
says you're going to get $20,000. That's why, right?
And people, and that's a responsibility of government too, an organization like ours and other organizations and communities, to provide the outreach and the training, you know, the base level for hygiene, for cyber hygiene. So that's something that is important. Schools need to get more involved. We need to get folks more educated earlier ages. If I can give you an analogy. It is, you know, I grew up on the East Coast. Years ago, New York City, 42nd Street, was a bad part of town. But those who knew the area knew that as it started to get dark, you didn't want to be around 42nd Street. But if you were outside the area, you didn't have that knowledge built up. You didn't have that third sense, or, you know, sixth sense, rather, to avoid it and to be looking over your shoulder and to be cautious. That's kind of what we need in cybers. We need people to get a little bit more savvy, a little bit more understanding of the environment, because it's not 42nd Street, it's our computer, right? It's in your kitchen. It's on your lap. And we need to not make some of these dumb errors.
Mm-hmm. So you think from a personal consumer standpoint, we just need to train ourselves, we need to have better knowledge, or is there something that we can do either down the road or, you know, if you're a consumer, like there was a lawsuit, an individual, I think it was Google, in the UK or in the EU, excuse me, went after, and the lawsuit was about personal privacy, and the EU actually stood up for the individual. Now, are we getting to a point where we're going to start seeing more and more of these, where companies are now going to be at liability for handling the individual's information?
Yeah, I mean, there's an argument out there that the internet has become an inherently dangerous product. That has some meaning in terms of strict liability, but what I'm getting to is there needs to be, we have an imbalance in the marketplace, an imbalance of rights, and the law is starting to address that slowly. Litigation is starting to roll out. But I want to get back to, and that will start to bring change, but I want to get back to individual responsibility and what are the incentives to change behavior? Certainly we can talk about egalitarian and getting smarter and, hey, we all have responsibility. And that will get some, you know, people will aspire to improve their society. It'll address some of that need that some people have to self-improvement and so on. But there is now this, there's also the privacy dimension. Everybody has a stake in improving their privacy, protecting their privacy. I mentioned the Apple FBI controversy, and that's just one of many. People are starting to get more in tune that their privacy is at stake. But, you know, there's the other part which really gets people motivated is their pocketbook. And there are a lot of stories that the attackers are getting so good. I'll give you just a snapshot. One of our colleagues with the Cyber Resilience Institute down in Arizona was involved with an exercise. It was a red team, blue team, which means that you had attackers and defenders, and they had some of the best defenders in Phoenix that were on the defense team, and they had a small cadre of attackers, red teamers, hackers, and the attacker, the day was cut short because the attackers so overwhelmed the defenses that they not only locked them out of their own computers, but they deleted programs. I mean, they just destroyed them in a short period of time, demoralized them. And that's how we are in this environment where everyone is subject to this kind of an attack if you're targeted. But a lot of times you can just be dragged up into a dragnet, and you can have your bank account pilfered. You can have your Social Security information, your credit card information. And it's all usually from clicking on an email you shouldn't click on.
Yeah. So we work a lot, and I'm a part of the Cyber Resilience Institute. We work a lot on trust and how can we then identify over time a new, we'll say an Internet 2.0 that segues everything so that there is trust and accountability that comes with that. So if you now line up that you know who you trust, you can hold their transactions accountable. And that's really the key feature of when you hear me be a proponent of cybersecurity ecosystem, is that's what the ultimate end state becomes. So as far as, you know, when we come down to even the Apple versus the FBI thing we've talked about a couple times, really you come down to somebody's trying to look at it and say, you know, the government, the entities that want to enforce, we need to know who we can put a finger on, who we can blame, who is at fault. And the same thing with this red team, blue team. I mean, that whole effort is talking about looking at traffic. And I equate that to the era of the pirates. The seas were uncharted, and you had all these pirate ships going around kind of at will. So what did the government start to do? They started to hire some of these pirates to be privateers. So now you had, everybody had their own pirates, and you had loose pirates, and it was a game of pirates back and forth about, you know, everything being open. And what happened and what ultimately solved that problem was charting the oceans, lanes, you know, making trust and accountability between all governments, where they said, you know, it's not okay for any of us to have privateers anymore. We need to all have a trusted environment where we determine what is acceptable. And what are your thoughts about that as far as, you know, the legal aspect?
We're getting pretty high level, and I'm interested in this space. But, you know, I'd say it's that gets into the nation state model, because legally, nations could regulate the seas. They could come together through treaties and put together mechanisms of enforcement. The challenge today is that the internet is so dispersed that someone hacking from a cafe in a foreign country has the power to contest nation states, right? A few hackers can get into the White House. They've done that. So the borders don't, the borders that protected the country for so long don't work anymore. It's porous because it's coming in from underneath. And so that whole centralized structure doesn't work anymore. We need this where we're all trusted into this ecosystem and we're all playing a part of it, which is a challenge to stand up. And but one of the real challenges to making this work, Chris, is that the aggressor ecosystem is now being commercialized. So mm-hmm. through the dark net, they are monetizing their crime. And through the dark net, because it's encrypted and anonymous, it's very difficult to deter. Law enforcement has having a very hard time breaking that. As soon as they take down a darknet site, another one pops up. And what we're doing as a society, because we're not decentralized, is we're fighting a profit center. The profit center would be the bad guys who are in these black markets, and they are scaling because they're finding a lot of success. They have a market forces approach, and we're still in a cost model, which mm-hmm. we're never going to beat a profit center with a cost center. And the way to do that, I think, is to incentivize security through these community organizations that can create a marketplace through a lot of different ways. And it's too long a conversation to go into, but that starts bringing market forces to bear as a defense mechanism, that you get cyber intelligence, you get certain advantages of being in that marketplace, that ecosystem. And then that also enables you to pool your resources to fight back, essentially.
Yeah, and that's exactly the CRI model, as to how can we start to put this together, to grow it from a network within a network of people banding together to make cybersecurity an industry that then has one identifiable risks, and that risk is identifiable or is transferable to return on investment.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay, as far as now, you know, you've been involved with the Colorado Springs effort from almost the beginning. I'd say, 2011, you founded a cyber exchange here in Colorado. So, and I've heard a lot about this in the talk. Tell us about what you see with this local effort, how it can come together, and what your recommendations are.
Sure. I mean, it's fun being here now in the state of Colorado with the National Cyber Intelligence Center. We've got our own pursuits that are really getting exciting. We're talking to the FBI, we're talking to the military, we're talking to, you know, intelligence. I mean, all this engagement shows that there's interest, there's traction, and we're moving forward, as opposed to years ago when they were sort of the early adopters, the evangelists saying, hey, we've got a problem, hello. And people didn't get it until it really started hitting their pocketbooks the way it is now. You know, I'm part of the ISAO effort, the Information Sharing Analysis Organization, which is came out of the White House. That's the standards organization is in UT San Antonio. I'm leading a working group. There's just a lot of organizing going on, and that's exciting. But we've got to get more involved from a community standpoint, more organization, more convening of the right parties. And the people that have learned the lessons the hard way, and I'm unfortunately one of those, and I know you've been in this space, and there's a lot of others, we've got to band together and make sure that we don't relearn the past mistakes. So I think having the right convening is critical, because one of our partners in CRI made the comment about, you know, not being able to see the opportunity without self-interest getting in the way, and that's sort of human nature. But we're building this cross between a fire department and a Pike's Market in Seattle, if you can get that vision, where it's got to start with a collective and a trusted, and that's the key part. To get everybody in, you have to have a trust framework that is to a level of sophistication, and by that I mean it's really got to be about promoting trust at the first instance, and throughout its structure, everyone has to trust each other. Everyone has to, the organizations have to be trusted. There has to be mechanisms to promote and assure trust, not just of the data, but just of the organizations to start. And a big part of that is transparency and your mechanism. So just one quick, and I'll be quiet, but one quick example is that if you look at how the Food and Drug Administration approves drugs, approves technologies, the people who know that, the experts, they typically have their own technology, their own business, and yet they're brought in. They're brought in to be sometimes an advisory panel. But they have to disclose their conflicts. And if they're too conflicted, they're too close to the initiative at hand, then they have to recuse themselves or they get excused by the FDA. And that's sort of the open, the palms up approach that we need. People coming in to a convening organization that ensures that those who are coming forward and want to participate, that they're building the firehouse. They're building the greater good. Because once we build that Pike's Market and everyone's trusted, then some opportunities start to emerge. But as soon as you have self-interest, then it starts to undermine the trust too early before it's built, and then you have breakdown.
Yeah, it sounds almost like the original founding fathers of the United States coming together and saying, how can we put checks and balances in? You know, how can we make this cyber world, which is now bigger than any of us, have these checks and balances where we build up the next generation of trusted environment from within the structure we already have?
Yeah, exactly. And I'll tell you that if we go down the pathway, our community, but other communities across society, of a contract with the state government or a contract with the federal government, look, those are at an early stage, there needs to be that seed money. But if you're trying to build a ecosystem, then a one-to-one environment means you have winners and losers too soon. And instead, we need to build the ecosystem, because then you have an industry that's starting to be created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So definitely a proponent there. I look forward to more from you, Doug. And advice to, if anybody listening from the Colorado Springs effort, what they should do, recommendations for moving this forward?
And I'm actually writing on this, and it'll be more in the Colorado Springs Business Journal about the trust framework. So there's the convening piece that's so important, the transparency. The organizations themselves, not only probably do they have to be nonprofits, but they have to be egalitarian nonprofits that really are about the big picture. And I think that the legal piece is also very, very important, because we have to identify the different facets of trust. And an organization that works for a client and only through ethical constraints can offer advice that's in their client's best interests, that's an important part of the trust as well. So there's a lot of different organizations that have a part in this, and getting them all to the table is the starting point.
I agree, Doug. Well, thanks for joining today. I was glad to hear your perspective and get your take on everything we have going on. And thanks again for listening today, and stay tuned for more on the cybersecurity effort in Colorado and worldwide, and connecting everything as we move forward.
Thanks, Chris. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.